For most of human history, dinosaurs did not exist. I mean, of course, evidence of their time on the planet and their demise lay buried beneath our feet the whole time. We just didn't know it. So until just over a century ago, there were no dinosaur toys, no blockbuster museum exhibits, no movies, and hardly any inkling of just how different the Earth had been in the distant past. And then came T-Rex. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. The fossilized bones unearthed in Montana in 1902 were not the first dinosaur remains to be found and studied, but the excavation of an extinct predator that had been 40 feet long, with a skull the size of a love seat, teeth as long as rulers, and then those weirdly tiny little arms, it tipped off a fascination with dinosaurs that would have implications for science, religion, and culture. And that fascination is still going strong today. David K. Randall is a senior reporter at Reuters who tells the story of how all this went down in a book called The Monster's Bones, The Discovery of T-Rex and How It Shook Our World. He joined us in July. David, welcome to Think.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
What evidence do we have from ancient culture and mythology that early peoples might have encountered dinosaur bones now and then and not known what they were?
That's a great question. So the idea that dinosaurs are a relatively new phenomenon, it really goes back to the idea that, you know, science has only recognized what they were recently. But, you know, obviously they've been a part of human existence since humans have existed. You can go back to see, you know, the Puritans when they first came to New England. They found dinosaur tracks, fossilized dinosaur tracks, and they speculated that, you know, perhaps these were signs of a bird that somehow escaped from Noah's Ark. When Lewis and Clark, when they went across the country, they most likely found dinosaur fossils in what is now Montana and Wyoming. And other Native American tribes, they who lived in that area, they had seen belemnites, which was a form of ancient squid. They saw that as battle armor. And you know, it was highly prized. And you can kind of see this in cultures throughout the world. In China, dinosaur fossils were known as dragon's bones, and they ground up into tonics.
I love thinking that all the dragon mythology might have come from people discovering dinosaur fossils.
That's one thing that I was really struck by, too, is that, you know, you had this idea that there were bones there and people tried to make sense of them. So you had all this folklore that came from that. So, you know, you have the dragon mythology, you have griffins in Europe, which were, you know, animals that had kind of the body of a lion and the head of an eagle and, you know, kind of slightly dragon-like. And, you know, you had all these ideas of people trying to essentially figure out what these things were.
Then as mining technology starts to get better in the 19th century and miners can go farther below the surface, more and more of these strange creatures keep turning up, right? Only at that time, there were actual scientists around to try and make sense of them. So first came geology and then this brand new field called paleontology.
Exactly. So we wouldn't have the science of paleontology, essentially, if we weren't looking for minerals and other, you know, precious items that were deep under the earth. So, you know, paleontology, perhaps more than other sciences, really owes its existence to capitalism. We're digging up the earth to try to find precious things. And lo and behold, we find bones there and we have to find out what these mean. So you saw this, the start of the science of paleontology in England in the 1860s or so. It was at this time that, you know, miners who were going into the earth, they started coming up with all these strange bones. And one person named Richard Owens, he was the first person who came up with the term dinosaur. And it was this idea that, you know, perhaps this was the first time that the humans made that big leap to say, Earth as we see it now is not how it always has been. That, you know, there's these evidence of these creatures that have lived long before us. And so therefore, maybe Earth has looked different in the past than it does now.
Why was the study of dinosaurs mostly limited to England for the first few decades that it was a thing?
Well, mostly it was kind of a combination of a couple factors. One was just pure luck. There were certain areas where people were digging in England that were now known as abundant sources of dinosaur fossils. There was this one young woman named Mary Anning. She lived about She was 12 years old, and she lived about 100 miles away from Jane Austen when she published Sense and Sensibility. That same year, she found one of the first known dinosaur specimens off these cliffs known as Lyme Regis, and she just happened to live there. And she found these bones, and you know, she had this talent of going into these cliffs and coming back with fossils, and then she would sell them, and that's how she provided for her family. So that was part of it, was just that there was, you know, the happenstance of people could find these and realized at the same time that there were scholars who cared to find out what they were. The second part of it was that, you know, some of the areas where we now know of, you know, abundant fossils, like Montana and the American West, there weren't that many people out there at the time who had that kind of scientific focus to find out what exactly these were. You know, you had this period of, you know, post-Enlightenment, industrial age, you know, the rise of natural sciences. And that's why you had, you know, lots of people in England trying to make their names up for themselves in science, and dinosaurs were one way to do that.
And then came this era in the United States of the Bone Wars. What sort of mm-hmm. early competition played out in the U.S. among fossil hunters?
So there were two men. Their last names were, one was Marsh and one was Cope. And they were both professors on the East Coast. And they both saw dinosaurs as a way to essentially make their name and to you know, have fame and prestige. And also they had been friends earlier, but then there was, you know, the sign that one person was paying off fossil hunters to help, you know, find better tips on where the bones were, essentially. And this led to, you know, a hatred between the two of them. So for the next 20 or 30 years, they tried to find as many bones as they could, identify as many new species as they could, publish as many papers as they could, all to essentially show the other person up. It was a fight of egos more than anything. But because of that, we found, we being, you know, the lay people, lay science, dozens of more species and a much broader sense of the variety of life of dinosaurs.
My guest is senior Reuters reporter David K. Randall, who's got a book out called The Monster's Bones, The Discovery of T-Rex and How It Shook Our World. David, I love that the guy who would eventually bring the first T-Rex skeleton up from underground to be displayed happened to be named after P.T. Barnum, because we have to imagine the guy who called himself the greatest showman would have done anything to get his hands on an exhibit like this.
That was one of those funny coincidences of history, I guess. So the person's name who discovered the T-Rex, and he was eventually known as one of the best dinosaur fossil hunters of all time, his name was Barnum Brown. And he grew up in Kansas right after the Civil War. And he received his name. He was the youngest of four siblings. And he received his name after, you know, his parents took his older brother, who was six at the time, to P.T. Barnum's Great Traveling World's Fair. And, you know, after Barnum was born, they didn't know what to name him. Then his six-year-old brother Frank just bursts in and yells, let's call him Barnum. And somehow the name stuck. And, you know, it had this kind of element of showmanship that didn't necessarily seem to make sense in Kansas. But as Barnum got older, he kind of grew into his name. He became interested in science after following his dad on the fields. You know, his dad essentially dug up coal and sold it. That was his job. So Barnum would follow around, and you know, he kept on finding these seashells, and he didn't understand why he was finding seashells when he was, you know, 600 miles away from the nearest ocean, which is the Gulf of Mexico. So that's what first started his interest in science. He went to the University of Kansas. He was among, you know, some of the first classes at the University of Kansas. So it was still a new institution. And that's where he essentially talked his way onto dinosaur digs. And in time, he found some of the first triceratops that were in the University of Kansas's collection. And he seemed to just exhibit this innate skill of going into the field and, you know, going over, you know, picked over areas where everybody else missed everything and come out with something new. And one thing I was really struck by was that, you know, I'm not a paleontologist. I'm a journalist. So this was all new to me. And one thing I was really struck by is that, you know, there's this inherent divide in paleontology. You have to have this really strong understanding of how science works and geology and, you know, how bodies are put together, so you can tell at just a glance of, you know, that's a leg bone, or that's a tooth, or that's something else. And you also have to be, at the time, especially, you had to be incredibly physically strong to go out there into the fields and withstand, you know, the punishing heat, the rain, all the elements, and also the idea that you're going to go out there and fail again and again and again, and only hopefully eventually find something. And if you find one thing, that can make your career. Barnum, he found dozens. You know, by the end of his career, he had discovered more than half of the fossils on display at the American Museum of Natural History in New York.
How did those early excavations work? I too didn't realize, I hadn't thought about how physically fit early paleontologists needed to be to physically do all this digging themselves. So, what was the process for those excavations?
Well, this is where it was still so closely tied to mining. They used many of the same skills that miners do, you know, dynamite, using certain tools to get deeper into the rock. And they used it for science. You know, and instead of trying to essentially blow things up to see what else was under there, they tried to, you know, blow things up with a purpose and to save what they wanted to save. So you had this skill that Barnum, this new field that Barnum helped develop. You know, at the time, going out into the field and finding dinosaurs on purpose was still something of a novelty. You know, most dinosaur fossils were really found by luck. You know, they just happened to be at the place where somebody else was searching for something else, or, you know, the first Triceratops skull that was known by science. It was found in Wyoming, when a cowboy thought that a steer had escaped from the flock, and he lassoed it, and he dragged it around, and then only later did he realize, wait, this is looks like some alien creature. So they had to really start this new science of this is what the rocks look like that are most likely to contain fossils, and then once you get there, this is a way to break off those first layers without destroying what comes underneath. And then once you do find a fossil, this is how you quickly wrap it in essentially plaster of Paris to prevent it from crumbling even further.
Sure, because occasionally they would send whole shipments back east and they would all have crumbled by the time they arrived.
Exactly. And that was Barnum's big fear. You know, Barnum, he grew up on a farm, and the idea of staying on a farm just seemed like torture to him. You know, he was somebody who wanted to find all the blank spots on a map, and the idea of being stuck in one place where your duties are circumscribed by the seasons, that seemed like the worst thing he could possibly do. So when he would send back fossils and they were destroyed, he was greatly, you know, fearful of the idea that this would end his career and that he would have to go back to Kansas.
All right, David, I want to talk just a little bit more about this. You mentioned people would look for like different colorations in the rock. I want to know how, before a lot of modern imaging equipment, how paleontologists and fossil hunters knew where to start digging.
So it was, in some ways, it was a process of trial and error. You know, you had people who would go essentially out into the wilderness and search, and over time they understood, hey, if you have a rock of a certain kind that has this certain color, that most likely meant it was the bottom of a riverbed or a stream millions of years ago, and therefore, when a animal died, and it was its body would then quickly get covered and start the process of fossilization before it could be picked apart by scavengers or something else. And this was really a completely new idea. You know, in the book, I say that this was almost like, you know, people going off would go off into the wilds of, you know, North Dakota or South Dakota with very little material with them. It was almost like they're going off into the shooting off into space with, you know, off into the moon with no supply lines. They really had to fend for themselves, and they're going out into the great unknown and really bringing back things that nobody expected to ever see.
And when in doubt, if you're not sure if you have just a funky rock or an actual dinosaur fossil, you put your tongue on it?
Exactly. So fossils are now known to be sticky. Your tongue will stick to them briefly. And, you know, some fossils have this, they almost look like they're aerated. They have little holes in them. And, you know, licking what you are dealing with has actually been a go-to for geologists for a long time if they're not quite sure what they're working with. You know, you can think of this as simply as, you know, rock salt. If you stick your tongue to it, it'll taste differently than, you know, perhaps clay will. Some materials will be stickier than others. So you have this idea of kind of, what I loved about that was this kind of idea of, we're going to figure this out as we go. And that's really the story of paleontology in so many ways. And the book really focused on, you know, these are the people who kind of figured it out as we went. You know, I guess one of the best comparisons I always like to say is, when you think about the space race and the people who went to the moon, you know, obviously the rockets are a big part of it, and the science of it is a big part of it. But I was always the most fascinated with the astronauts themselves. You know, why would they actually want to do this, and what pushed them to do that? And that's what, you know, Barnum Brown is such a good story of. This is what drove someone to go out there and look for dinosaur bones, and he was the one who ended up discovering the T-Rex.
So how did Barnum Brown end up on the payroll of Henry Fairfield Osborne, or maybe more accurately, Osborne's wealthy father?
So Henry Fairfield Osborne, he was, you know, this the son of the elite and living in Manhattan. Theodore Roosevelt was one of his childhood friends. And he was somebody who kind of rose higher in life, you know, floated on a cloud of his family's money. He eventually became the head of the vertebrate paleontology division at the American Museum of Natural History in New York when the museum was really in its infancy. And he saw dinosaurs as a way to kind of maintain the family prestige and also make himself kind of larger than life and in scientific circles. And, you know, and at the same time, earn the respect of his father. So he's looking for somebody to fill the halls of these empty dinosaur halls. And Barnum Brown already has this reputation of being, you know, they called him Mr. Bones. He's the person who could go out and find better bones than anybody else. And he just seemed to have this, you know, otherworldly sense of stamina and understanding of just how the world worked, the physical world, the natural world. So Fairfield or Osborne contacts Barnum, and soon Barnum discovers the first museum, the first fossil, dinosaur fossil, that's in the American Museum of Natural History's collection, a Diplodocus. And this was the thing that really wove together the stories of two men whose lives were so different that, you know, you wouldn't think they would even be, you know, in the same chapter, much less bound in the same book. But they found something together in the search for dinosaurs. And then, you know, this started a career that for both of them that would really be intertwined, even though they came from different parts of the world and saw dinosaurs and dinosaurs fulfill different purposes in their lives.
My guest is journalist David K. Randall. His book is The Monster's Bones, The Discovery of T-Rex and How It Shook Our World. So, David, there had been drawings of fossils in books for a long time. How did it happen that impresarios and museums started to realize a life-size display would be a draw like nothing else?
So the first full dinosaur specimen found in the U.S. was found in suburban New Jersey, right outside of Philadelphia. And the Philadelphia Academy of Sciences, they had this bright idea to say, you know, we've all seen these pictures of dinosaurs, and, you know, some of us have seen fossils on shelves and laboratories. Let's mount them. You know, let's essentially make a life-size sculpture using these bones. It was in between, you know, a museum display, and a lot of it really was sculpture because you had to build armatures that held all the weight of the bones with also trying to disappear at the same time and make them the bones of this creature appear lifelike. So when it finally goes on display, you know, more than 100,000 people stand in line to view this. And this was, you know, double the annual attendance of any year in the museum. So very quickly, it becomes clear that the public loves dinosaurs. They might not understand them, and they are still seem somewhat of a novelty, but it's this idea that you can walk and see these, otherworldly monsters that really makes people in the scientific and the museum world realize that they want to have them and they need to have them if they want to stay relevant.
Yeah, so Osborne was running the American Museum of Natural History in New York City, which of course is still going strong. And it comes into existence at a time when there are tons of hoaxes on display, passing as genuine curiosities, but it's all sort of for entertainment's sake. How did a museum like the Museum of Natural History try to compete with the kind of sensational P.T. Barnum, Fiji Mermaid stuff that was available elsewhere?
That's where dinosaurs came in. So the American Museum of Natural History, they had all these fascinating objects and these scientifically important things, but they also seemed, for lack of a better word, boring. You didn't have people want to come in and say, "That's a very interesting rock." They needed to have something. Even in the museum trustees, they wrote a letter saying, "We need to find a little bit of sugar to sprinkle with our wholesome bread." And that's where they see dinosaurs, that this is something that has some scientific importance, but at the same time, bring somebody in the door, and then as they're there, they're going to start to see everything else. And on top of it, they're real. They're not a mermaid. They're not, something else that's just a hoax. So you have this period of time where, the millionaires of their age, the captains of industry, the J.P. Morgans, the Andrew Carnegies, the field marshal, the Marshall Fields, they have all this money. They want to say, we need to, I want to donate this and create an institution that will show the importance of science and show people the spoils of capitalism, as it were. And we need something that'll bring people in the door. So you had all these millionaires saying, "I have all this money. I'm going to donate it to your museum, but you need to find dinosaurs for it to be worthwhile for me."
I liked learning that because it made me think about the fact that today, billionaires seem really bent on going to space. There's sort of a parallel there.
Exactly. It's this idea of saying, "This is, I need to do something with my money that no one else in the world ever could." And you have this idea where, even though you have, the Elon Musks and the Bezos of the world who say, "I have all this money and what I want to do with it is shoot myself into space," you still have this, century-old idea that dinosaurs, and specifically the T-Rex fossil, connotate some kind of cultural legitimacy and have this kind of cultural power that very few other things do. There, in October of 2020, there was a auction by Christie's in New York City of one of the most complete T-Rex specimens ever found. It was nicknamed Stan. And it was supposed to go for $8 million or so. After the exhibit, after the auction, however, it sold for something like, $31.8 million, and it was sold to a mystery bidder, and nobody knew who it was for a long time. Only a few months ago, however, the buyer identified themselves. It was the United Arab Emirates, and there is going to be a it's going to be the centerpiece of a new natural history museum in Dubai. And it really speaks to the idea that you need to have a dinosaur, and specifically a T-Rex, to essentially feel like you're in the big leagues when it comes to museums.
But not a lot of museums have $31 million to spend on a single exhibition.
Exactly. So that's where you have in paleontology circles this idea of that, somehow dinosaurs have, especially the T-Rex, have transitioned from not only a scientific object but into a commodity, that this is a status symbol. So there are very few T-Rexes that are found, and very few that much less come to auction. So when there is one, it becomes this almost existential race of how can we get one? How can we make ourselves seem as important? And that's where Barnum Brown kind of came in too. Not only did he find the first one, he found the first three, and nobody else found another one for another 30 years. For a generation, almost a generation and a half, the only place in the world where you could see a T-Rex was in New York City. And because of that, it had this outsized impact not only on science, of course, but also on pop culture, that you had, the most intimidating, ferocious creature that ever walked the earth is also when, one of the busiest and most important cities in the world.
So, David, to the shook our world part of this story, what did people do when they suddenly had like incontrovertible evidence that history might not have played out precisely the way it did in something like the Bible?
So you had this idea as paleontologists uncovered more and more dinosaurs, there was this gradual understanding of perhaps the history of the world is a lot different than we thought. The T-Rex is what really changed it and essentially forced people to pay attention. Before, all the dinosaurs that had been put on display were mostly sauropods, which were, the large long-necked dinosaurs like a brontosaurus or a brachiosaurus, and they're all herbivores. And it was always, it's almost a novelty in a lot of ways. It's the look, they're almost like giant cows. If you think back to the original Jurassic Park from 1993, the very soaring, gentle part where the John Williams music is very calming, those are all the brontosauruses, the nice dinosaurs, if you will. It's when a T-Rex enters the picture that everything changes, because it starts to dawn on everybody that if you have a carnivore of this size, everything about the world has to be more complex. Obviously something this size has to go hunt. So that means there has to be more abundant food than perhaps anybody thought possible. So that means there's more abundant life forms. If there's more abundant life forms and they're dealing with a predator like this, then they must have some kind of natural defenses. And maybe we haven't found, spikes on all these dinosaurs. So that maybe that means there's a larger, a social order, or there's safety numbers somehow, which implies, some kind of more complex animal behavior. And you start to think of that, all the dramas of everyday life of predation and evasion and luck and skill and everything else have been happening for millions of years, well before humans entered the picture. So as soon as the T-Rex was displayed in October of 1915, suddenly museums and scientists across the country were deluged with letters saying, what does it mean for humans if something so ferocious once walked the earth and is now extinct? Are humans going to go extinct now too? It was almost like an existential crisis.
Had Darwin known much about fossils and the possibility of creatures like dinosaurs?
So Darwin, he had an inkling of dinosaurs, but they were kind of on the margins of scientific thought at that time. So one of the first places that Darwin, or one of the places that Darwin went to, was Patagonia. And there were now that's known as a graveyard for monstrous creatures. Some of the best dinosaur fossils and the most important dinosaur digs now are taking place in South America. But Darwin didn't really know what to make of them. It wasn't until later that, Richard Owen and others really started pushing this an idea that dinosaurs were not just a one-off, and instead were a vital part of human history, of not human history, of the Earth's history.
So people may notice that you earlier said that the first exhibition of the T-Rex happened in 1915. I think earlier we mentioned that that first T-Rex was discovered in 1902. What was the delay about?
Part of it was that it was very complicated to create a display for the T-Rex. Some of it was just the fact that the process of taking off all the little bits of rock that were still stuck to the fossils took a very, very long time. It was Barnum Brown later said that it was the hardest stone that he had ever encountered. And part of it too was, it's kind of the puzzle piece. You find a fossil, it's not just all laid out as it was. There are
Right.
tons of little slivers of it. So you had to create this idea, create this new science of essentially gluing it all back together. And then on top of that, there was the question of exactly how should it, how, what did it look like? The fact that its forearms were so tiny puzzled everybody. They didn't seem to make any logical sense. So for a while, Osborne thought, Osborne, who was, still the museum in charge of Brown, he essentially tried to tell him, go back for more. Maybe you're missing something. So it was this idea of that, what exactly do we have here?
All right. So Osborne says to Barnum Brown, go back out there and find another T-Rex. Now, the fact that he had found a T-Rex in the first place was pretty astonishing. I mean, did Brown feel confident that he could, make lightning strike twice effectively?
I think he did. So Brown's whole, essence in life was that he was going to find as many find more bones than anybody else. He was terrified of having a boring existence, in other words. So he, he had a life that spanned the world. He searched for bones in Mongolia and Canada and South America and everywhere else. So he had the sense that he could do it. And he was also willing, he found the first T-Rex outside of Jordan, Montana, and he was willing to go places nobody else was, and he always came home with the receipts.
People may not realize that I think to this day, the dinosaur that is on display, the T-Rex on display at the Museum of Natural History, is actually like a composite, right? It's bones from more than one animal.
Exactly. So when he found the first one in 1902, the skull wasn't in good enough quality in Osborne's opinion to display. So he asked them 2 years later to go back and find another one. So he goes back, this time Brown, and he takes his wife Marion along with him as well. And lo and behold, they soon find two more T-Rexes. And it's from these two that they essentially pick the best bones of each and make what is now the iconic T-Rex on display in the American Museum of Natural History. The very first one that they found, however, the museum still kept. And one of the last things Brown did before he retired from the museum in 1941, New York at the time, there was this idea that it was going to be bombed by the Nazis. And New York, like many other museums on the East Coast, started this process of trying to hide all their treasures and send everything far away from the coast as possible. So the American Museum of Natural History, it's kind of stuck in this position that many of the materials they have are gigantic, or they weigh so much. It's very hard to move a meteorite very easily. But one of the things they do box up is the original T-Rex, and they send it to Pittsburgh. So if you ever go to the Carnegie Museum of Natural History in Pittsburgh, the T-Rex on display there is the very first T-Rex that was ever seen by human eyes.
This is interesting because the Carnegie Museum was a real competitor with the Museum of Natural History for a long time, right?
Exactly. You had this era where dinosaurs were the trophy, and the T-Rex, when Barnum Brown found that essentially won the competition for the American Museum in New York. But for a long time, Osborne was terrified that the Carnegie Museum was pulling ahead. And you had the other large competitor in this was what's now known as the Fields Museum in Chicago. And that was the museum that actually had a early lead. A paleontologist there found Brachiosaurus, which is, the really tall, long-necked dinosaur. The front legs are taller than the back limbs. And that seemed to put them on pace for becoming, the place, the museum for dinosaur fossils in the U.S. Then, the curators of the museum suddenly decided that, dinosaurs were not going to be a big deal. They started pushing all their resources towards something else. It was only then that, and to the 2000s, where the Chicago Museum bought what is now known as Sioux, which is also one of the best T-Rex specimens ever found. And that's, once again, now it's like the most important item in its collection.
My guest is David K. Randall. We're talking about the monster's bones, the discovery of T-Rex, and how it shook our world. David, who got to name T-Rex?
Osborne did. That's another funny thing. And that one thing I actually liked about Brown is that for all of his skill and all the things he found, he didn't have much of an ego. He wasn't somebody who really cared about getting the credit. And it worked well, actually, because Osborne was somebody who cared incredibly much about getting the credit. And even the name, kind of speaks to this idea of showmanship on Osborne's part. He called it Tyrannosaurus Rex, which translates to the Tyrant Lizard King. And it was kind of his way of saying, we've won the competition. We have the most important specimen now. Most other dinosaurs were named after, things about their body somehow. Like Brontosaurus translated to thunder lizard, which is the idea of that, when something this large was walking, that was the sound it was going to make. Triceratops is, because of three horns or something else, some kind of obvious idea. Tyrannosaurus Rex almost has this lyrical showmanship quality that didn't really make sense of the time and place, but it was a way for Osborne to feel larger and to make his museum feel larger. And that's one of those things that, I think many people miss, that there's a real human story behind dinosaurs too. It's not only 65 million years ago that's important. It's to me, it's just as important to say, how have dinosaurs and the idea of dinosaurs changed culture? And the book is really about the people who did that.
What kinds of art and literature started to be created to reflect this moment when we discovered that dinosaurs had existed?
So dinosaurs played some of the first villains in early movies. The original Lost World, Sir Arthur Conan Doyle's book, the T-Rex is, when they make the film version of it, the T-Rex is the bad guy, essentially. And the original King Kong, before you get to the New York part, there's a battle between King Kong and the T-Rex. And it was because of this kind of larger than life villain and this early special effects that really helps push Hollywood and the movie industry into becoming bigger and bigger. So we wouldn't, not only would we not have a movie like Jurassic World Dominion, which just brought in $145 million or so in its first opening weekend, you probably, if it wasn't for Barton and Brown specifically and the T-Rex, and just the idea of these paleontologists who brought dinosaurs into popular culture, you wouldn't have all these other, this broad movie industry where you have this sense of spectacle and horror and the ability of movies to take you to a time and place that you could only imagine.
What kind of sacrifices did Barnum Brown make in his personal life to have this globe-trotting career where he would be in the field sometimes for 18 months, 2 years at a time?
So Brown had both a life of incredible accomplishments, and he also, had an incredibly tragic life in many other ways too. So Marion Brown, who I mentioned before, his wife, who went with him on some of the dinosaur digs, they had a daughter named Frances, and they lived in Brooklyn. And Brown kind of felt like, okay, I can have a semblance of a normal life. I'm going to be with my family most of the year, and then in the summers I'll go off into the field and hunt for dinosaurs, and I can continue to do this. Frances and Marion, they both contracted scarlet fever, and Marion died, but Frances survived. And Brown didn't really know what to do with himself after that, so he gave his daughter Frances to her maternal grandparents, and he essentially said, I don't feel fit to be her father. I don't feel fit to do this. And he essentially tried to escape into the wilderness and find the hardest work he could find. It was almost like he was willing the elements to kill him. So he stayed in the field for prolonged periods. He went to, desolate rural areas of Canada. He went to Cuba. He went to Greece. He went around the world, essentially trying to stay one step ahead of his pain. One of the redemptive qualities I found in Brown was that towards the end of his life, he went out of his way to make a relationship with Francis again. He was in his late 70s, early 80s, and they were going to create the 1964 World's Fair in Queens, New York. And as part of that, they were building a gigantic T-Rex display. And he made it his kind of mission to spend as much time with Frances as he could. And that idea of, he would tell her all these stories of her mother, of his life in the field, of all these different adventures he had. And they found a way to connect through their shared love of the T-Rex. She had a tragic life as well. As a teenager, she would go to the American Museum and walk the halls and see all these dinosaur specimens that her father had found and almost search for a connection with him, trying to find out, you know, how can I learn more about him just through seeing these dinosaurs?
Did she become a scientist in her own right?
No, she almost seemed like she, if whatever compass he was pointing to, she was trying to do the exact opposite. You know, he was somebody who was the life of a party and traveled the world. She was a college dean who sang in church choirs. She was, you know, very buttoned up, where he was somebody who, you know, was always the life of a party.
So Henry Fairfield Osborne, the guy who was sort of the administrator behind all this and raised the money for Brown to go out and do his work, he had some strange views, for one thing, about human evolution and eugenics. Was he ever sort of held to account for those beliefs?
No, not really. This was a time when he kind of controlled the scientific narrative in many ways. And he had, you know, many racially based scientific theories that even at the time nobody else really believed. And this was a time when race was a big deal and a focus of many people in science. The idea of, you know, how did different races evolve? Osborne's idea was that there was parallel evolution, that, you know, people who had European ancestry were of a different species than people who could trace their ancestry to Africa. Nobody else really believed this, but he focused on this a lot, and he focused on eugenics, which was the idea that, you know, there are only certain people who were more qualified, in quotes, should reproduce. And he used, in some ways, he used the popularity of dinosaurs to further these ideas. You know, the American Museum of Natural History, because of dinosaurs, became more and more famous. And he opened it up for a eugenics conference where there was discussion over, you know, of planned who should be able to reproduce, what is best for the quote unquote, what's best for the race. And, you know, you had this kind of dark circle where people would come in to see a dinosaur, and the T-Rex specifically, because it was so outstanding and spectacular and something that you could see nowhere else in the world. And then you would walk the rest of the museum and you would see these subtle hints of eugenics and this kind of racial-based idea of how science works and why, you know, some races are superior to others naturally, that Osborne focused on. And it was the power of dinosaurs that let him push this other narrative.
So the troubling power of dinosaurs now is that there is this market, right, for certain kinds of fossils that exist to this day. Some of them are plentiful and there's enough to go around. Is anybody trying to regulate when there's competition between like a scientific institution and a private collector? Is anybody trying to push the scale toward the institution able to do research on this thing as opposed to just the rich person who wants to possess it?
Well, that's where some corporations try to come in. So when Sue came up for auction in the 2000s, McDonald's was a big backer, because they found that, you know, if we help this institution buy this spectacular fossil, we will not only get something out of it, but we can, you know, we can use it in our own marketing and everything else. But that's where things are changing now. You know, the law of fossils, essentially, that if it's in your land, under your land, you own it. There's nothing much more beyond that. That the property rights are very much in favor of the landowner. So you have you know, these landowners in places like North Dakota or Montana that are known for fossils, to saying, you know, I'm going to spend a lot of my time just looking for the next fossil, and that's going to be my meal ticket. And then you also have the other idea that the impetus of showing wealth has kind of changed. In the Gilded Age, the idea was, you know, I've made all this money and I want to demonstrate it and kind of give back to the community. I'm going to donate it to a museum. Now there's kind of this cultural shift where it's, I've made a lot of money and I'm going to use this as build out my own private collection.
David, it's been a real pleasure. Thanks for joining us today.
Oh, thank you.
That was my conversation from July with David K. Randall, a senior reporter at Reuters and author of The Monster's Bones, The Discovery of T-Rex and How It Shook Our World. If you like this show, check out our conversation with anthropologist Sarah Parsak, author of Archaeology from Space, How the Future Shapes Our Past. You might also like our show with science writer Brian Switek, author of Skeleton Keys, The Secret Life of Bone. You can like our page on Facebook, we're at KERA Think, or subscribe to our podcast for free wherever you get podcasts, or go to our website where you can also see upcoming shows. That's at think.kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.